May the words I speak and the words we hear be your words of life to us, our God. Amen. In case I forget later, each week I've been trying to put out a little sheet, a different one, about how we might engage in climate change, anti-climate change activities, we might say. So this week there's a sheet out there for ideas for encouraging sustainable living. So there are still copies of the other weeks. There's lots from last week about honouring animals. So poor old animals. So that sheet is on the side where the tax receipts and the parish magazines and all those kind of good things go. So that's there. No, I can not worry about that. So a few, 2 years ago, around the time that Ian's funeral was, and somebody here was having a 90th birthday, Bonnie and I went to Wellington, and we'd had quite nice weather and company while we'd stayed with my mother, but in Wellington, it was what was described as a weather bomb. Why anyone would try to use an umbrella in Wellington is beyond me. I never owned one in Wellington. It's a waste of time. But that is a photograph of some poor soul in Wellington. And it was amazing. We were there for 3 days. We got to our motel. The power went out. It was pouring with rain. It was freezing cold. The wind was just blowing as it only can in Wellington. And it was magnificent. It was wonderful. So there was no point staying in our cold, dark motel. So we kind of got into our rain jackets and puffer jackets and everything else, and off we went for 2.5 days of excitement in Wellington. And I had a great time. It was wonderful. But I also recognised, and people, when I came back and they said, oh, I'm sorry about your holiday, and I went, it was great, it was amazing. I just really loved being in the middle of that storm.
You were
going
to say you soaked it up.
Ah, well, yes. Well, Bonnie did. Her feet were soaked the whole time. My feet stayed relatively dry for some reason, but hers were not dry at all. But I recognised that for other people it was horrible. Families with kids, you just couldn't go out. It was, the picture theatres did well if you were willing to brave going anywhere. So there were traffic warnings, don't go out unless you have to. It was amazing. But for people with families, it wasn't amazing. For people whose holiday plans were disrupted, there were no ferries going during this time. There were no planes landing in Wellington. It was way too wild. So all of that, and then there was a lot of property destruction. So I had a great time, but I recognised a lot of other people didn't. 40 years ago, we turned up to school one day, and the teachers never came to the classroom, and we started getting a little bit antsy, and eventually, kind of an hour or two into the morning, the prefects came round and said that we just needed to stay in our rooms, that it was not going to be a morning tea play time or anything like that, and we got really antsy, like, why aren't there teachers in here? Why is just a prefect coming to tell us this? We deserve teachers. What's going on here? What was going on was part of our school was blowing down. So one of the blocks, I think the roof had lifted and it just started to disintegrate. So this was in April and it was the Waiheni storm. So that was not a great experience of storm. I think I can remember when eventually parents were contacted, I don't know how they contacted them given this is pre-cell phone day. How did we get hold of people before we had cell phones? So there were no text alerts sent out. I'm pretty sure I can remember corrugated iron flying down Karori Road as we drove home from school, which just feels really dangerous, but I'm pretty sure it was quite dangerous. And it was horrendous. The Waiheni got stuck in the rocks, and if you went to Seatoun, it felt like it was just there, and that was the problem, because it was just there, and they were on the Waiheni, and they could see the Seatoun shore, and it was just there, but the current and the wind blew them the other way. And that was fine as long as you went with the current and the wind, but lots of them tried to get to the Seatoun shore, and that's where the troubles were. And of course, once you got to shore, There ain't no sandy beaches on either side of that harbour, so you were just flung into the rocks, as you can see here. So that storm brought a lot of death and a lot of damage. My grandparents' house was up Mount Victoria looking south. They survived. Their windows kind of held together, but their next door neighbours had a really big picture window looking south, and the window blew in and it just ripped the roof off the house and did incredible damage. So, and that was a story repeated again and again and again across London. So, one story about a great storm and one story about a horrific storm. What about your stories? What are your experiences? I invite you to turn around and talk to your neighbour about a storm. It could be either good or bad, and what made it a good or a bad experience for you. In a minute or three to talk about that. What are your experiences? All right, storms. We've all been in them. So what made storms bad experiences for you?
I was just talking about when the Bridal Bridge was down and my father, grandfather, had pneumonia and had to go to hospital. It was over the other side. So he had to go by boat.
Oh my goodness.
I was terrified. I didn't want to lose my grandfather.
No.
I wouldn't be able to take her up with him anymore.
All the important things. So bridges go down. We've got a picture of a bridge going down shortly. So what else just absolutely disrupts your lives?
Anyway, the Queen came and opened the new bridge.
Oh, well, that was a plus on that side, but we're not up to the positives yet.
Well, even more horror.
Yes.
No one ever expected what I needed to.
No, they didn't. No, it was unthinkable, really. Yes.
We had a holiday permit from... and there was a storm when we were there, and beside us was a pine forest, but they were only young growing pines, and the trees were bending up. They sort of just came over. And then, of course, there was that storm that came through from Gisborne that went right through to Taranaki.
Yeah.
And all that was, that included a lot of damage.
It does, yeah.
Yes. Where I grew up in the Orange Free State, we'd have dust storms.
Oh,
and they would, the sky would just go absolutely red, and you knew it was coming, and it took a while to come. And that was an incredible hush over the land. And it was phenomenal, because once it struck, everything just got covered with dust. It was a huge amount of work, but then waiting for the storm was pretty dreadful.
Sometimes you don't know you're in a bad storm. Like in the Waiheni storm, we didn't know how bad it was. We were just grumpy. Our teachers hadn't bothered to come to class, which is a little rude. But also, you are in the middle of that storm and you know how bad it is and you don't know how long it's going to last for. That just... I mean, Bonnie and I had great, well, I had fun in Wellington, but there were a whole lot of other people who just didn't know how long that weather bomb was going to sit over Wellington for and when it was going to move on. In a way, we're in the middle... Oh, sorry.
I was out in Alice Springs about 9 months, and went we had a sandstorm, and it's so different from a water storm, and... everything gets in your eyes, and the power of what is coming behind that sand is absolutely amazing.
It is. Yeah, I'm sure it is.
Yes.
One of our parishioners, Joyce Cameron, they lived right on the waterfront.
Yeah, well, the Waiheni storm, the vicar that I was curate under had been at Eastbourne, so they actually took parishioners up to where the boats were coming in and helped with the rescue operation. So storms can be bad, but storms can also be good. Who had good... Janet did. The Queen came. Is there any other good stories about storms?
Well, as kids we used to be very excited. I mean, you know, the scrim rattle, the iron lifted 6 inches off the floor and we could look out and watch the flakes rising.
Yeah, very exciting at night, especially you can see all the flooding.
Yeah.
I sat with some other children living very old in Australia on one of those old swing chairs with the fringe on the top on the balcony during a storm. Every time the lightning crashed, the whole bay lit up and we cheered. We had a great night.
Walking along the beach when there's a storm is really exhilarating.
It can be.
And picking up shells and that have got washed up, that wouldn't normally have got washed up.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like the dramatic ones are amazing, and in fact, lightning storms are really important. Lightning storms, they burn up a lot of pollution in the atmosphere, they cool the atmosphere, and farmers really like lightning storms because it's where the nitrogen, so there's a lot of nitrogen in the oxygen, but plants can't use it. But it's the lightning that frees the oxygen, the nitrogen, and allows it to be wrapped up in the water molecules so they can get down in the soil and become nitrates that the plants can use. So we need lightning storms, and they're amazingly dramatic. Although David Elliott had a great story this morning. He was playing golf and he was about as far away from the clubhouse as you could be. So he went for the nearest shelter, which was a tin shed. He said, in hindsight, that was probably not the best place to go and hide during a lightning storm. I don't know what you'd do, really. The trees are out, the tin shed's out. So, and a lot of the rain that comes ashore actually comes ashore on storms. And while it feels bad, it's those big storms that replenish the water table. And that's really important. And while it's not great seeing our plants being destroyed, in fact, one of the roles of storms is to rip out the weak plants, the damaged plants, and to make room for the new growth to come up underneath. So, which seems brutal, but that's how nature works. And I mean, this isn't really about storms, but static electricity that sits in the atmosphere is really good for plant growth as well. If your plants have everything else that they need, like water and nutrients and things. And one of the sheets that I looked at actually had how you can put copper wire around your veggie garden to kind of attract the static electricity to your veggie garden to help your veggies grow. I thought that's interesting. And there's a lot more static electricity around in a storm than there is in a calm day. So that's when they bring that stuff. I mean, storms also have a spiritual element to them. Did anyone talk about what it was like from a spiritual point of view, being in the middle of a storm?
I just think it's awe-inspiring. It's got to be something beyond us.
Yeah. A long time ago, Bonnie and I helped run what was our job to run adventure camps in the Otaki Gorge. We had groups going out for 3 to 5 day tramps around the Tararuas. And on one of those occasions, one of the groups had gone up to the Kaim Hut. So we were really hoping they hadn't gone up there because a just big storm came raging in. And the mountain safety guy said, I think we need to go up and check that they're not there. So he and I went up to Kaim Hut, which is a very long way above bushline. Like, it's Mount Hector is one of the highest points in the Tararuas. It's just below there, and it's one of the points where people get into real trouble. So we boldly went off into the middle of the storm, and I remember that because we could not talk to each other for the entire time, which was several hours we were climbing above bushline because of the force of the wind and the rain. All you could hear was wind and rain on your jacket over your head, kind of done up tight and trying to look away from where the rain was coming, try to rip your eyeballs out, and they weren't there. So then we had to go back down again. But it was like the same experience in Wellington, just hunkering down and being, there was no way Bonnie and I were going to talk to each other while we were moving from building to building. It was too wet, too noisy. You just worked out where you were going and went there as fast as possible, as carefully as possible. And it was like that on Kaim. You're just kind of drawn into yourself, but then there's that awe at what is going on around you, which is what the psalm is about, isn't it? It's that the awe of the storm and how that draws the psalmist then to see God at work in that. And out of that comes the sense of reverence for creation and for God. I mean, it's a great phrase that the cedars of Lebanon skip. You can imagine what those trees are doing in that storm. And Job is talking about exactly the same thing in terms of wisdom. Well, the reality is that we are in the middle of a climate change storm, which in part has its origins in the world that God created, but in part has been exacerbated by our actions, particularly our actions in the West. And so there's the bridge down the South Island as it went, which was just amazing to watch that bridge kind of buckle in and let go, and to see the power of that. And we know that the storms are getting bigger. They're becoming more frequent, and they're becoming far more destructive, and that's not going to slow down. That's just going to pick up pace. So can't get it to go, and then it goes a million miles. Spent a lot of time on Friday trying to find this quote. It was somewhere on my Facebook page, and I couldn't find it. And then last night I worked out how to Google search it with the right words, and that took me 10 seconds, which was very disappointing. So Gus Speth is, actually don't know how to say his name. He's an American, he's a lawyer actually, but he's been involved in a lot of environment protection stuff for the last 30 years. And if you can't read it, he says, "I used to think the top environmental problems were biodiversity loss, ecosystem collapse, and climate change. I thought that 30 years of good science could address these problems. I was wrong. The top environmental problems are selfishness, greed, and apathy. And to deal with these, we need a cultural and spiritual transformation. And we scientists don't know how to do that." So that's our problem. The scientists are speaking, but the real problem is the greed and the selfishness and the apathy that is at the heart of our society. So who knows how to speak to that? Well, maybe we do. Maybe we have something to contribute to that discussion. One of the things that we in the West need to, particularly the church in the West, needs to begin with is by acknowledging that we have provided the theological undergirding of that selfishness and that greed. That for a long time we have said that this world is God's, that God gave us this resource to use as we see fit and to create economic wealth. And that we don't need to worry about the consequences of that. And the church has said that repeatedly for a long time. So I began a number of weeks ago by telling the story of the Archbishop in Adelaide when I was at a meeting of young people who said that we don't need to worry about environmental issues. The environment is here as a resource so that we can create jobs and economic wealth. Don't worry about the environment. Don't listen to the environmentalists. So that has been an official line from churches for a long time. We have provided the theological underpinning for that. And there are still churches today doing that. Conservative churches saying, economic wealth is the primary thing that we need to be worried about. So that's the first thing we need to acknowledge, that we are complicit in this. But then we need to think about what exactly we offer instead. And Pope Francis has been probably one of the more vocal people in terms of this. So there are a number of quotes that I'm going to put up here, and I'll talk about each of them. The urgent challenge to protect our common home includes a concern for the whole human family together to seek a sustainable and integral development, for we know that things can change. So one of the things that Pope Francis talked about in Laudate Si, or in English, Praised Be, on the care of our common home, which was his encyclical in 2015, he talked about an integral theology. And by that he means that when we talk about environmental issues and climate change and those kind of things, they are not divorced from how we treat other people. They are all wrapped up together. And one of the podcasts I listened to this week, the people are involved in sustainability stuff in terms of building products. And they'd just been to a conference where the state sustainability, I think it was the state, maybe in the city of New York, sustainability officers were talking about what they're doing for sustainability. And amongst those things, they talked about making sure that the living wage was paid across the state, providing good accommodation for the people who live in the city, etc., etc. None of which sounds like it's to do with climate change, but actually it's all to do with climate change, because how people live and how we treat people is all tied up with how we treat the environment. They are one and the same. So one of the things that Pope Francis talks about, so in this next one, in the face of the emergencies of human-induced climate change, social exclusion and extreme poverty, we join together to declare that human-induced climate change is a scientific reality, and its decisive mitigation is a moral and religious imperative for humanity. Pope Francis keeps talking about the fact that in Scripture, humans are to live... Scripture talks about how humans live both with God and with each other and with creation. And that for too long we've just talked about how we live with God, with a little bit of how we live with each other. And that each other has tended to be limited to people like us. And so we don't have to worry about other people. And we can see that across the world. I mean, the best examples of that are in America. I mean, it's the glaring example when they talk about how we live with our neighbour. They mean white people like us, and not their neighbours across the border or anywhere else, or people who don't look like them in their country. And we could look at them, and they're a great kind of icon that we can look at, but then it invites us to look at ourselves and how we do exactly the same in this country. Maybe not quite as visible, but it happens here as well. So this, and that's all tied up with the creation of economic wealth. When economic wealth is your primary goal, then everything else becomes a resource that can be used in that. And so Pope Francis has also said, economic powers continue to justify the current global system where priority tends to be given to speculation and the pursuit of financial gain. As a result, whatever is fragile, like the environment, is defenceless before the interests of the deified market, which become the only rule. And you'd have to include in that the poorest people in the world. They also become defenceless. And we can see that in Brazil, where people have been, the forest has been chopped down, but also people have been moved off their land, so that things can be grown as commodities to sell to the West. So it feels like it's good, because that'll help the Brazilian economy, but if you're the poorest, you're the losers. And the reality is, in the world, the people who will pay the greatest price for climate change are also the poorest people, the people least able to do anything about it. So where is God in all of this? This morning we heard the great story of Jesus asleep in the boat. And sometimes it feels like Jesus is once again asleep in the boat, and some of us are begging him to wake up. And there are a significant number of Christians who would say, first of all, that going back to Job and the psalm, that this is an amazing world, it's a huge world from our experience in the storms, which teach us about our smallness and our insignificance, that how could we possibly do anything that could damage this world? Climate change is a hoax. Humanity couldn't possibly damage this world. We don't need to worry about it. It is anti-Christian to suggest that we have. It's not a position that I give much credence to. The science is clear. This week, The Guardian published an article, I think it was The Guardian, that now 99% of climate scientists agree that climate change is happening and it's human-made. 99%. So this is happening, we have done it. The next position that a lot of Christians have is that Jesus will wake up and will save us. So we don't need to do anything, because Jesus will make it right. And, you know, there are people in the city who believe that. Well, I would say God can, but how does God make things right? Through us. Through people. So maybe when we look at that picture and see Jesus asleep in the boat, it's not Jesus asleep in the boat. Maybe it's us asleep in the boat. And it's us that need to wake up. Wake up to what is happening around us. And one person that I read this week said, the kingdom of God is like being asleep in the boat and waking up to the world that is around you. And what does that world look like? Well, Paul says in his letters, not explicitly in the letter we read today, but certainly it undergirds his theology, that that in the covenants, God promised to renew creation and restore humanity. And that in Jesus, in the cross of Jesus, that covenant is fulfilled. It has begun to be done. And how was God going to do that? Well, mostly through the people who followed, the people who joined in that way. So it wasn't about coming to church, it was about what happened the rest of the time. We are the people who fulfill that covenant, who restore creation and renew humanity, or the other way around. So that's at the heart of what Paul was about. But also in there is the cross, the storm of the cross, the storm of the crucifixion. Jesus was not saved from that storm. Jesus went through that storm. And in that event, but also in the story of the boat, there is the promise that we are not left alone. We are not left alone in the boat on our own. We are not left alone in the storm. That God will be with us. There was never any promise that we would avoid the storm. Jesus didn't say, come and follow me and everything will be peachy. Jesus said, those who want to follow me, take up your cross. Follow me into the death, into the storm of crucifixion. And you will know that I am there. It's a hard thing, but it's a hopeful thing. In the midst of the storm, God is there. God is there. And in the version of the story we heard this morning, Jesus doesn't say, peace, be still. But in some of the others, he does, in Mark's version. And it's often, who's Jesus saying that to? Peace, be still. Is he saying it to the storm? Or is he saying it to the disciples? And well, maybe both. Maybe both. The storm needed to hear it, but so did the disciples. They needed to hear those words of comfort, of restoration, really. And all of that brings us back to Job, the first reading we heard. Job, who talks about his experience being in the midst of the storm, where I began this morning. Job's reading was the invitation to wisdom. Job is all about wisdom. I think it's one of the most important books in the Bible, and Job is about wisdom. And where is wisdom to be found? Fear of the Lord. What does fear of the Lord look like? Should we be afraid of God? That's how we often translate that. No, it's not about being afraid of God. It's about being in awe of God. It's about standing in the middle of that storm in Wellington with all that rain and wind banging down on top of me and being in awe of God who created the storm. And being reverent towards God and the world that God created and the world and the people who live in this world. Fear of the Lord is about reverence and respect. And that's what we're invited to by Job and by the writer of the psalm. So our starting point in addressing this moral and theological issue has to be one of reverence. Reverence for God and reverence for the world that God created and reverence for all who live in it. So how might we start then? Well, first of all, we need to be informed. We need to know what's going on. But secondly, out of that being informed, we need to pray incessantly. And thirdly, out of that prayer, we need to be open to being changed and to do things in different ways and to speak into situations in different ways. So next week, we will look at that. So, that's a long sermon. Miriam's been timing it. She'll be able to tell me exactly how long it was in the end. So I invite you to turn around and to talk to your neighbours about what stood out, what questions do you have, and what now. So you've got about a minute just to chat to your neighbours. And then we'll do some praying.